Hey, everybody, it's Lisa Lampanelli, the Queen of Maine, and you know what? I got my own podcast. Yeah, does everyone have one? Pretty much, but mine's different because I'm going to help you like I help myself. Get Stuffed with Lisa Lampanelli every week is going to teach you how to have the fabulous life that I have. If you don't listen, you're just stupid and don't want to help yourself, so don't even listen. I don't even want you to. But if you do, if you disobey my orders and listen, you can go to feralaudio.com or download it from iTunes. But again, don't listen. I don't even care.
Today's episode is brought to you by Last Rampage, the new true crime film starring Robert Patrick, Heather Graham, and Bruce Davison. And we had the pleasure of speaking to someone involved with the movie.
So my name is Alvaro Rodriguez. I'm the screenwriter for The Last Rampage. As a writer, to me, I'm less interested in genre and more interested in character. And, you know, I've written in a lot of different genres, you know, kind of horror genre, thriller or action movie or kids movie or, you know, different kinds of things. And it was always more, I was always more interested in character and hadn't really quite done something like this before, but was just really drawn to this idea of a guy like Gary Tyson who, you know, had been in and out of institutions from the time he was, you know, a kid, and having sort of raised three sons from behind bars. And how these three sons kind of grew up in the church of Gary and thinking that their father had been, you know, unjustly accused and unjustly convicted and all of this stuff that they were getting fed from their mom, Dorothy, who's played in the film by Heather Graham. So to me, it was just, I was interested in telling that kind of a story, telling a family story. You know, to me, the most interesting stories are family centered in some way, you know, they're elemental stories. They're stories that go back to, you know, to the most intimate and elemental parts of ourselves. So the idea of fathers and sons, you know, there's a line in the script about, in the movie about that, you know, where Gary tells his oldest son, you know, Donnie, there's only one law you got to worry about, you know, and that's a law of fathers over sons. And the only way you're going to, you know, get past that is, you know, by this, you know, by dying, basically, but kind of threatens him a little bit. But so that was really, you know, the touchstone for me, trying to figure out how to tell that story.
Don't miss Last Rampage, the true story of the prison break of Gary Tyson. In theaters September 22nd and available for on-demand pre-order August 22nd. Find out more on Twitter by following at Last Rampage Film or on Facebook.com/Last Rampage Film.
Feral Audio.
Hey, this is a very special episode of the X-Files Files. This episode, I talked to Mark Snow. So I was obviously very, very excited. It was a huge thrill. His music is very, very important to me. You know, I can't think of the X-Files without thinking of that music, and I can't listen to that music without thinking of the X-Files. And I think of how many times that music terrified me, and it's the single thing that got me excited to watch the show again. You know, as soon as I started the first episode, the music came on, and I was like, oh, yeah, right, this is going to be great. You know, whenever I think of the show, I think of that eye and the stretchy man and that disco ball thing with the electricity on it. And I think of the music and I think of being in Pakistan and watching the show and, you know, thinking the world is way weirder and cooler than I thought it was. I've talked about this on the show a bunch, but this show just made the world seem bigger, you know. And there were a few things that just like become part of your DNA. You know what I mean? Like you like a lot of stuff, but few things really crawl in there and stay in there forever. For me, it was Indiana Jones and Ghostbusters and Gremlins and Roger Rabbit and definitely The X-Files. And part of all that was the music. The music is the link to the sensations I felt then. This music is a bridge to my childhood. Like they said, the sense of smell is most closely related to memory. I bet sound is second because every time I hear the music, I feel something crazy in my loins. I go back to my childhood arguing with people about whether the show was real. I go back to reading UFO books when I was a kid, looking at checkerboard burn marks. I go back to seeing that picture of Loch Ness Monster. You know that one that everyone's seen where it's in a silhouette and I'm remember looking at it and going, how can they say it's not real? Look, this is a fucking picture of it. It's right there. Or I think of stories of spontaneous human combustion or doppelgangers or people who can bend spoons with their mind. And all that stuff crystallized on The X-Files for me. And I get a weird, compressed version of the excitement of all those things right when the music first kicks in. Right away, the world gets weirder. And not just that, seeing this show that was so wonderful inspired me to try and get into this field. You know, the idea that I could try and make other people feel the things, the kinds of things that I felt, was so exciting and undeniable. I just couldn't not try to do that. I wouldn't be a comedian if it wasn't for Ghostbusters or Gremlins or Indiana Jones or The X-Files. And then when I think of what the music means to the show itself, you know, there's always the cold open, something crazy and magical happens. It's alien and fucking weird, and you're like, how could this make sense? And then the music drags you into the world we know, the world of The X-Files. Shit is crazy out there, but don't worry, our guys are on it. That's what this music means to me. So I kind of wanted to say all this stuff to Mark Snow when I was interviewing him. I was going to talk to the exact person that inspired all these feelings. But there's that weird balancing trick of telling someone how much their work means to you, but also not freaking them out and doing a good job. So I was really nervous and I couldn't sleep the night before. I'd spoken with him a bit before to schedule it. I knew he was a really nice guy, so I wasn't nervous for that. I was just nervous. I don't know. It was one of those. I'd scheduled it for pretty early in the morning, and I woke up at 3 a.m. and I was like, fuck, I missed it. And then I woke up at 4 a.m. like, fuck, I missed it. And then I woke up at 5. I missed it. One time I remember I woke up and I just put all my clothes on and I was like, oh, it's only 5 a.m. So I was super crazy nervous to talk to him. And then Dustin came over, the producer, and I'd written all these questions for Mark Snow, you know, that I was going to ask him because I was nervous. I wanted to really prepare, fall back on it in case I got tongue-tied. And one of the questions was, what was the process of writing the music? Was it that you guys went back and forth and tweaked it a bunch? Or did you just write it and send it in and be like, fuck you, say no to this, you know? Because to me, that piece of music is so perfect, as music and also the theme for The X-Files. And I honestly never got to ask that question because you sort of answered it. And the answer that he gave me was so surprising. So please listen to this. And then I have some thoughts about the interview right afterwards because, you know, I just sort of couldn't stop thinking about his answer to that question. I hope you guys enjoy this. Great. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I want to say, you know, I've been doing this show for about a month or so, and The X-Files is my favorite TV show of all time. And, you know, every time I hear your theme, I always get chills down my spine. There's never going to be a time in my life where I'm not going to have a reaction from listening to the music you made.
Well, thank you so much for that.
It really is. I mean, it's rare that a TV show where the theme song is so tied to the TV show, you know? It's like such a big part of people's experience of the show.
Well, I think that's, writing music and coming up with these things is always an adventure and an incredible, you know, abstract experience. You never know what's going to kind of pop out. And how this one came about is even more interesting than most. I don't know if you know about the story behind it.
No, I don't. Please tell me.
Well, Chris Carter, the creator, he came over to my studio and brought a whole bunch of CDs and telling me he likes, you know, the percussion on this thing, the singing on this, the guitars on this, the ambient stuff on this. So I said, okay. And I did something. And he came back and said, well, that's good, but it ain't, you know, just the. So anyway, this went on two, three. It went on two more times. So there were three attempts I did, which I thought were a little more, I don't know, maybe what you might expect or standard or something. And he was being very, very respectful and decent. And I said, look, here's an idea. Why don't you let me erase all of the ideas, you know, we've had so far and just start from scratch. And, you know, maybe I could come up with something that's really more unique, etc. And he said, okay, great. So he walks out, and I happen to have a certain kind of sound element on my keyboard, and I just put my elbow down accidentally, not too hard, but, and there was this delay echo effect on this piano sound, and I heard it, and it was the sound of the da 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 da.
Yeah, oh wow.
And I thought, whoa, that's cool. So, and then I thought, well, what about the notes? You know, so eventually I came up with the four notes, da ba da da ba da ba da da ba da, and it had that, you know, echo.
Yeah.
Delay effect. And, you know, one of the things we discussed, or Chris really wanted, nothing slick, nothing overproduced, nothing traditional, but really ultra simple. So I thought, okay, well, here's a cool little accompaniment piece. And I knew the whole theme couldn't last more than 40 seconds. So I thought, well, all right, that's a good little rhythmic accompaniment. Now, what else could there be in this thing? And I thought, well, he liked a lot of, you know, pads and sustained ambient stuff. So why don't I come up with a clever combination of that underneath there as a sort of a supportive low tone, and then write a melody on top of it all. So I came up with the melody, which is, you know, in reality, fairly simple. And it was, okay, fine. Now what instrument or sound is going to play this? So I experimented with everything from piano to strings to woodwinds and voices and, you know, xylophones and all kinds of stuff. And I'm screwing around, and this patch on one of my samplers comes up that says Whistling Joe. And I said, oh, what's this? I open it up and play it. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. But still, you know, it wasn't, the other things I wrote before this were real pounding, bam, jam, 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 you know, like what you'd think might be in some sci-fi show. So I thought maybe we could get away from that. And so I put this whistle on and just kept thinking about, just keep it simple, simple. And there's a little low percussion hit at the beginning, boom, da ba da da ba da da ba da da, and it also ends the piece. And I remember my wife heard it and came in. She said, oh, that's different. That's nice. I mean, but though, you know, no one's jumping up and down yet. All right. I said, okay, well, I'll bring him back and we'll see. So Chris comes back and he hears it and says, well, let's hear it again. I do. And he says, oh, that's good. All right. Well, let's go with that. You know, but still we were all pretty, you know, oh, this is okay. You know, I'm glad he liked it. And I felt good about doing something different. So then, just as sort of, the next part of the story said, now, look, we have to play this for the executives at Fox because they have to sign off on it. And I said, oh, all right. So in those days, when it was 1991 or something like that, I think, or two. But he said, all right, show up at this office. I'll meet you there. You know, bring a boom box and your cassette. And I said, all right. So we show up and he meets me there and he says, oh man, shit, I have to go. I have to go to a casting meeting and stuff. Look, you take care of it. It'll be fine. Oh, no. Oh, nice. Thank you. Yeah. Anyway, I go in there, three guys in suits, very polite, very nice. Sit down. All right, let's hear it. Boom, play it. And then I'm quiet. And one of them says, well, you know, I think what it just, I don't know. I get, and then he looks to his partner and he said, Bill, what do you think? And Bill goes, you know, it feels, I have a reaction, it's just, and he turns to the other guy, and the other guy goes through the same thing. So basically, they're not saying anything because they don't know. They're dumbfounded, you know, because nobody was going to say it sucks or it's fantastic. So
right, they don't want to commit.
Right, no one was going to commit. So anyway, a few months later, the thing comes out and it's like everyone's talking about it and it's becoming, you know, sort of a big deal. One of these guys called up and said, hey, Mark, yeah. Hi, this is so-and-so. Remember the meeting we had? I said, I do. And he said, didn't I tell you how fantastic this was? And I said, you sure did. Absolutely. So anyway.
So you know how to work in showbiz, Mark.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say, you know what? You're a so-and-so and... you're lucky you have a job. Now, hang up the phone, you know. So anyway.
So when you guys did the theme, you're saying that, as you said, your wife said nobody's jumping up and down. So that theme is the theme that everyone knows from the X-Files. You guys weren't super excited about it. Is that right?
Well, no, yeah, you know, it was such a different approach to what, you know, I think a lot of people were thinking the theme of the X-Files was going to be. I think, you know, everyone was ready for more activity, more percussive pulsing and, you know, some strange sounds or, you know. But I think the thing that made this thing so unique was it's kind of a really creepy, quiet type piece. It's not over the top. You know, and to think of this whistle thing, you know, as the lead melody line, you know, the last time I heard that was on the Andy Griffith Show, you know.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I guess that's why the theme works so well. It's because it works well with the visuals and the feel of the show. And not to say that it doesn't work on its own as a piece of music. I remember later there were dance remixes and stuff, right?
Oh, there were all kinds of things. I mean, the guy, I think his name is Mike Oldfield who did that great Tubular Bells piece. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that.
Actually,
one.
Actually, it became the theme of The Exorcist, the first Exorcist movie.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, I know that.
And it had like
right, yeah.
You know, anyway, so he did a version of that, and a bunch of, you know, remix guys did, and a guy in Nashville did a slide guitar kind of Chris Isaac type moody version. So it's been all around.
I mean, did you expect that all that was going to happen when you were in that meeting playing it for these three executives? Were you surprised at how successful a piece of music this became?
Yeah, it was like I just couldn't believe it, you know. And what's, you know, sort of wonderful and scary at the same time, you know, coming up with it wasn't particularly, you know, I wasn't, you know, under the influence of anything or, you know, like pushing and straining and trying to and racking my brain and going through some kind of, you know, 10-hour artistic, you know, fit or something. It really just happened so quickly and easily, you know, and I thought part of what I thought was, well, let's do it again, get another show and do it again. Well, nothing has been anything like that. And it's still this fantastic mystery, just how it came about in the first place. You know, when, you know, my wife said, oh, that's very nice. You know, and Chris Carter comes over and says, yeah, that's good. And, you know.
Yeah, your elbow hits a key and you find Whistling Joe and the rest is history. I mean,
that's, That's pretty much it. Yeah.
I just, you know, I've been rewatching. I hope this isn't scary. I've been rewatching the show for the fourth time. So I've seen the seasons three times. This is the fourth time. And every time, the thing that gets me in the mood is listening to your music. Like, as soon as it plays, I'm like, all right, I'm back and I can't wait to watch all of it again. Had you seen the pilot when you started coming up with the theme song? Or was this before the pilot was ever made?
No, I did see the pilot. And the pilot was, they temped the pilot. In other words, they took music from other sources, like some film scores and TV scores, and put it in the pilot, you know, as temporary score. And all of that music was really ambient and sort of sound design and very, you know, vaporish and, you know, there was no melody, and you know, and everyone said, "Gee, this is what we like now." So when you do the score, we just like this feel. So you know, hang on to that idea. I said, "All right." So, but before I did the score of the pilot, I did the theme, and in a funny way, that really didn't dictate what the score of the pilot was, you know, because that theme had a little, you know, jaunty rhythm, but in a kind of spooky way. They really wanted lots of sustain and just support the dialogue. Don't get in the way, you know. So that's what I did, and it turned out to be, gee, for a 42-minute show without the commercials, you know, maybe 35 minutes of music, which is a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the thing for me that always is exciting is when I would see the show on TV, there was always a teaser, you know, before the show started. And it was usually, those things were always so beautifully written and directed and produced and acted, you know, and it was always, you know, it starts out, all those teasers usually started out fairly innocent. And then in that, whatever it was, 2-3-4 minute, you know, period, just build. And it would be a big, yeah, you know, and then all of us, it'd go to black for about 2 seconds and then bam, then it goes into the theme. And I always thought, wow, that was how that laid in there at that specific time was just so perfectly, you know, done.
Yeah, it worked so well because the cold open became such an iconic part of the show as well. So it'd be, you know, someone's just going about their day and then suddenly, a vampire or whatever it is, and then they die quiet for a second, and then the music saying, oh, our guys are on it. Don't worry, they'll figure this out.
That's it. Yeah, that's a good interpretation.
So when you watched the pilot, did you like it? Did you feel that this was a special show that was going to connect with people?
Well, what was interesting was, you know, at that time, years ago, Jillian and David were like babies. I mean, you know, I forget how old they were, but they just looked, you know, like 15 years old or something. You know? And their experience, you know, with each other was like limited, or, you know, certainly nothing. And I was thinking, wow, this is a pretty cool subject. And I was wondering, are these kids kind of up to the task? And as the show went on, I mean, you're talking about the pilot. I thought the pilot was really great, but I was wondering, wow, you know, can it sustain and where's it going to go from here? And it's just amazing how they grew into the parts. And even more amazing is really the ensemble. You know, there are some of the actors who do return, you know, have recurring roles. That was always great, you know, to have this ensemble group. But I'm even talking beyond that. I'm talking about the the ensemble of writers and directors, you know, and producers. It was such a, the chemistry with this group of people was pure magic. You know, it's as if, you know, if someone got knocked out of the loop there, the thing would kind of fall apart, which didn't happen. You know, there were a couple of guys who came and went, but there was this sense of how the thing should be constructed and where do we go from here and can we get black humor into it and what about all the mythology shows? You've got to keep a thread going with that. You know, it's just that, you know, it's like, you know, either like the cast of a sitcom or a TV network drama show or cable show that's gone on for a long time, that the chemistry with the actors and the writers and directors, producers, that's always to me a magic thing. Because as we know, many TV shows are made and not many succeed.
No, not many do, and very few sort of become, you know, iconic and legendary. Next Files is a show that I think is going to be around forever. I should have asked this a little bit earlier, I guess. The opening credits, the way they look, had you already seen that when you were making the music? Or because the part of the thing is the visuals and the music work so well together that it almost seems they were created at the same time. Now, I know that's impossible, but had you seen the opening credits when you were scoring the music, the theme?
No, it's a good question. I just did the music and they gave it to the, you know, the picture people, and they went to town with it, you know. And I think they had the same, I wouldn't say problem, but the same experience. Like they did 3 or 4 or who knows, 10 maybe, you know, versions of the thing, different, you know, combinations of, you know, edits, etc. And finally it became what it is. So, yeah, actually, so the music came first and then the picture came after.
I mean, those worked so well together. So it seems to me like you were a fan of the show. You obviously, I mean, you know, you watched every episode because you had to score it, but you liked watching the show as well.
Well, I did. You know, I certainly was so intimate with every moment of every episode. It was, if I had the time on whenever night it was at first, I don't know, I think Friday, then Sunday, I'm not sure again, but it was always fun to be able to turn on a TV in one part of the room or whatever house I was in, you know, to experience that and hopefully having it sound as good as I remember when we mixed it. And it always did. I remember some of the sound effects editors would complain to Chris Carter, say, "Oh, this music is so damn loud, you know, turn it down. We can't hear our, you know, our traffic noise." And he said, "Well, that's how we're doing it now." So, you know.
Do you have a particular episode you really liked, or is there a particular memory scoring an episode that was challenging or interesting?
Well, you know, with the X-Files, I just can't even possibly say my favorite. You know, I can remember some. As soon as I remember one, it reminds me of another, so forth and so on. Right. You know, just right at this very second, for whatever reason, maybe it might be totally unexpected, but the very last episode of the whole series, which was one of the few times I could use the theme with the whistle as a very melancholy, you know, somewhat sad piece that for me wrapped up all of those episodes, you know, because I hardly ever used the theme in the episodes. It wasn't quite right, but this moment, you know, I think Mulder and Scully are in bed in some hotel after, you know, God knows what happened, some major situation. And, you know, they're kind of emotional with each other, but, you know, they're just kind of holding on to each other, just like kids lost in a storm or something. And having, you know, hearing and playing that simple whistle theme, you know, slower with either, I don't even know if there was any accompaniment to it. I don't know. It was, they all came over to watch, you know, that last episode at my studio, and I kind of teared up and I looked over, and these tough guys, you know, they weren't, you know, they weren't gonna show their feelings about it, but no one said anything for quite a while. And I think we were all thinking the same thing, the end of, you know, a huge, huge part of our, you know, professional lives that was so incredibly potent and remarkable and, you know, ever to be repeated again. Well, sort of unlikely, except in the case of perhaps Vince Gilligan with Breaking Bad.
Yeah. I'm getting like choked up a little bit just hearing you tell the story of it. I'm getting chills down my spine.
Yeah, my wife made some, you know, some snacks because it was just about lunchtime and drinks, and we're, you know, sitting around, or not sitting around, standing in the kitchen we had at the time, and everyone's kind of just quiet, and, you know, we look at each other and, you know, give each other a hug and say, okay, well, see ya some other time.
but I mean, it's also satisfying. I mean, you guys did this huge thing, and, you know, putting a bow on it at the end must have felt gratifying in some way. Like, oh, we can't fuck this up anymore.
No, that's right. You put it right. You know, I get a little, you know, emotional about just reliving that moment. You know, it was, you know, to think 9 years and where it's, how it started off, you know, and it's really, you know, something special, really amazing.
So I asked people on Twitter if they had any questions for you, and people came up with a couple of really great questions. One, did you have a hand in picking the other songs in the show? I just watched an episode called Beyond the Sea, and, you know, Bobby Darin's Beyond the Sea, that's where Scully's father passes away.
Yeah.
That's a big part of the song, a big part of the show. And then there's an episode later called Home, and Johnny Mathis's Wonderful, Wonderful plays at a very, very intense point of that episode. Did you have a hand in picking those songs as well?
No, I you remember, it was Glenn Morgan and Jim Wong, who I think did Beyond the Sea, and maybe even Howard Gordon.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, I think they did that. I was so busy with the score all the time. I never was involved in, you know, those source pieces or the, you know, or the songs. And they didn't ever hire a music supervisor, which wasn't all that in vogue at the time. But these guys, you know, had a good sense of what was current, you know, or not. You know, sometimes there would be opera or, you know, stuff, big band from the 40s, and, you know, et cetera, old rock and roll. And, you know, so it was always cool what they chose. So, you know, I'm glad I didn't have to sweat through that stuff, because that's a whole other thing, you know, picking a bunch of things, songs, and let's hear it. Oh, try the other one. What do you think? Oh, what do you think? That's, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. You know?
Yeah, I mean, but whatever they picked worked so well with the score you had. Another person, Kristen Sauter, asked, how was it the first time to play the theme with an orchestra?
It was very exciting, and I had an orchestrator who really did a great job in mimicking the, you know, the rhythmic part that repeated da ba da da ba da da ba da. So he had many instruments just trail off from one another, you know, descending dynamics. So ba ba da da ba da da ba da da da. You know, so that was pretty cool. And high violins and piccolo played the whistle part. And recently there was a concert at Royce Hall at UCLA where they played music from current TV shows. And I was one of the guys on it, and where we played the theme from Millennium and X-Files. But I mean, to be really honest with you, the original version is to me the trademark, you know.
Yes.
unless it's like, you know, God, a 150 piece orchestra, you know, playing, you know, loud, and you know, there's, for me, there was nothing that could really top the first thing, you know, the first pass at it.
Yeah. And you were saying how it's interesting, you know, a lot of people have these stories about coming up with these things, and there's some kind of thunderbolt. And what you said was that the story of coming up with the theme, there really wasn't that moment where you were like, aha, this is it, we've nailed it. It felt like everyone just kind of was like, well, this is pretty good. And it's something that sort of grew on people as it went. Do you remember realizing at a specific moment where you were like, oh, this theme is really, really special?
Well, you know, my job is, you know, the part of the definition of my job, and I think other composers for TV and film, is collaboration. So I could think whatever the hell I want, and it didn't fucking mean a damn thing, you know. And if Chris Carter comes in and says it sucks, well, that's it, you know. And if you want to be, you want to, you know, be an idiot and start arguing, well, that's fine up to a point, and then you better just shut up and, you know, write something else. But there was something, you know, the innocent simplicity and quiet of it that the, you know, immediately, I don't think any of us knew that it would be so, such a big deal, you know.
Yeah, and it certainly, it was a big deal. Thank you so much for talking to us, Mark. This has been such a thrill. It's been so fantastic. You know, when someone contacted me saying that they knew you, I literally closed the email and didn't look at my computer for an hour because I was scared to read it. But thank you so much for talking to me and creating such an amazing piece of music. You know, as I said, I'll be 80 years old, and when I listen to that music, it'll bring me back to being a little, you know, 13-year-old in Pakistan, getting scared in the dark.
Yeah, and I understand you're on a show yourself, acting, right? Is that right?
Yeah, it's called Silicon Valley on HBO. You should watch it. It's a fun show. It's a comedy.
Yeah, my friend said check it out because it's really, really great. I look forward to it. That's exciting. And I thank you so much for, you know, your questions were perfect. It wasn't wobbly, or it was really beautifully put together. And, you know, and when that happens, it's a pleasure talking about the X-Files.
Thank you so much, Mark. I hope to talk to you soon.
Very good. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye. So like I said, great guy. He had great stories. But one thing that really struck me was, you know, the process of him writing the music wasn't that exciting. I wrote all these questions, you know, and I was like, or did you just give it to him and be like, yeah, fuck you, say no to this? And he was like, no, it's collaborative. You know, if Chris Carter says no, it's back to the drawing board. And it just kind of made me think of this lesson that I've learned personally not too long ago. And it's the single most important thing I've learned as a writer and as a stand-up comedian, is that inspiration isn't always a thunderbolt. You know, it isn't always accompanied by angels singing to you. Sometimes it's just an errant elbow and a whistling Joe setting and your wife going, it doesn't make me jump up and down. And then slowly the work you did is imbued with meaning. Other people's experiences imbue it with meaning. You don't create it in a vacuum. I just couldn't stop thinking of the fact that they were all just kind of okay with it. You know, Mark Snow was okay with it. Chris Carter was okay with it. His wife was just okay with it. And it was people's connection to it that made it ultimately so special, you know? You create art for whatever your reasons are, but its legacy is determined by the people experiencing it. You know, for years I thought of that moment, you know, Mark Snow's in his studio, he writes the music and the heavens open up and he's like, all right, I nailed it. Or when he started, you know, telling me the story of how he met with the Fox executives and I was like, oh, this is going to be exciting. They're going to be like, this shit is huge. And it wasn't like that. It wasn't exciting. It was never exciting. And it hit me so much when he said, I was just going to move on to the next thing, you know? And as someone who does stand up and writes, I learned this lesson a couple of years ago and it completely changed my life. It really has. The lesson of, you know, not to wait for magical inspiration. And for me, with writing stand-up, I became much better when I realized how much work goes into it. You know, I tell these long stories, like these 7-8 minute long stories in my stand-up, and most of them took months to, like, get ready. And it wasn't a particularly exciting or romantic process. I write everything down. I bold the stuff that I think is funny. And then I look at it and see, like, all right, this area doesn't have enough bold stuff. I should write jokes there. Then I'd go out at night, try the story, come back, rewrite the parts that work, that didn't work, go out, try it again, do that whole process over and over for months. And these are stories I'm very proud of, but I, you know, I have no, like, specific memory of where I wrote them. There was no, like, specific aha moment. And my writing really, and writing became much easier for me when I took off the pressure to, like, write something amazing, you know? I just try and write something that isn't horrible. I took off the pressure to, like, dazzle myself. And I think I'm better now than I've ever been. I mean, there's obviously a lot of work to do and I have a long way to go, but my special, Beta Mail, it's on Comedy Central, go buy it. I'm really proud of it, and most of it was written in non-Thunderbolt ways. Dan Harmon, who a lot of you know, he hosts a show called Harmontown. He said, and Dan's a wonderful, amazing writer, obviously. He's a genius, but he said that he considers himself a bad writer, and only 2% of what he writes is good. So the process is you write it, then you take out everything that's bad, and then you rewrite it. Now you've got 4% that's good. Then you take out everything that's bad, then you rewrite it. Now you've got 6% that's good. And so it's hard work and sweat, you know? And then later you imbue it with moments of excitement and mystery. Like, I was in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, which is where I started doing comedy, and there was the Starbucks I used to go to write, and I would just go there and write in the afternoon, and I wrote this one-man show there. And when I was back there a week ago, I had this very strong visceral reaction when I walked by it. Like, this was the first piece of comedy that I'd written that felt personal and real, and it just expanded my idea of what could be funny. And I wrote it all at this Starbucks. And when I saw the Starbucks, I had this sense of, like, this is where I found myself as an artist, which I understand is very self-aggrandizing. But you write stories about your life, you know, you add meaning to things later. But really, it was just a place I would go, and you hope to get a good seat, and it didn't smell bad, and then I mythologized the process later. So it's interesting how Mark Snow created this piece of music, and he had the sense to know, you know, just on to the next thing, and he didn't burden himself with trying to make magic. Magic just happened later when I touched all these people. I just moved to a new house, and I'm like, I'm pretty sentimental. Like, there's a new Radiolab episode, I think it's called Things, and it's about how some people give meaning to things, to objects, and some people don't, like physical objects. I certainly do give meaning to objects, like my X-Files DVDs, you know, I'll never get rid of them. I will always have them. I know you can watch them on Netflix, and I know the Blu-rays are going to come out, but I'm always going to have these DVDs because these are the DVDs that, you know, help get my wife into the X-Files. And before me, I think I told the story here before, I got all of them off some guy on Craigslist whose girlfriend had dumped him. So whenever I see these DVDs, I think of that. I think of, you know, the history that he had with them. And I think of Emily slowly falling in love with the show. And I know that it's nothing intrinsic in these physical objects. It's not magic. It's my brain is assigning meaning to this, you know, physical object. But I like that this physical object has the property of getting certain parts of my brain firing, you know? Same with, like, video games. Like, so we were moving and Emily wanted to throw away Halo 2. And I was like, no, this is the disc. Like, this is the first game we beat together. And she was like, let's get rid of Saints Row 4. And I was like, no, this is the first video game we played together in different rooms. And then I think of this house I just moved into. It's just a piece of real estate, you know? And I'll have memories here, and I have this office in the guest house, and I will hopefully make stuff there that I'll be proud of. But right now, it just feels like a nice place. And I get my coffee in the morning, and I walk across my yard. And walking across my yard puts me in the right headspace to write fucking whatever, to write something. And that's the thing that this interview drove home again, is that, you know, to remove the burden of expectation, the burden of perfection, the burden of magic. Just do your job and create, and what you make might take on a life of its own. And something that doesn't even inspire your wife to move may end up scaring the shit out of a little Pakistani boy, inspire him to grow up, move to America, follow his dreams, and start a podcast about the very thing that scared the shit out of him. Thanks for listening.
Hey, wrestling fans.
And non-wrestling fans.
Check out our podcast, You Should Love Wrestling, the show where we try to convince our friend to love wrestling.
I hate wrestling.
We talk about all the best and worst parts of wrestling.
Like Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Spills a lot of beer.
Or Yoshiko.
That's a literal sex doll that wrestles.
All in an effort to help you love professional wrestling.
Subscribe to You Should Love Wrestling on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app.